and you're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live, and joining me on the line is Professor Gerald Horn.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you doing?
Okay. You know, first of all, Norman, thanks to you and a different book list, that wonderful store, bookstore in Toronto, for arranging for me to visit Toronto, where I could see so many friends. And I had a lot of conversations with friends while I was in Toronto, and I'd like to ask you a question, because one of the things that struck me, which was unlike previous visits to Canada, was that I was told repeatedly that if there were to be a referendum on Quebec sovereignty today or tomorrow, that this referendum would probably prevail, and that Quebec would be declaring its independence of a sort. And my question to you is various. Number one, do you agree with that perception? And then number two, what impact would that have on Canada? For example, I was told that Quebec is, to an extent, to the left of what we might call British Canada or English Canada, and that if Quebec were to secede, that would mean that English Canada would be more susceptible to entreaties from south of the border and would fall more deeply under the influence of the United States. I guess my overriding question is that would Quebec sovereignty be a step forward for progress, so to speak? Would it be good for people of African descent, for example? I understand that the Quebec nationalists are much more encompassing than they may have been in the past, of people of color and people of African descent in particular. I understand that there are some people of Haitian origin and Cameroonian origin who are playing significant roles in the sovereignty movement. So that's a lot to chew on for early Saturday morning, but I'd be very curious to hear your opinion.
You are a professor, aren't you? Is this the midterm or is this my final?
No, I'm just because.
No, I can deal with it.
I'm thinking about this issue too. I'm wondering, for example, if Quebec declares its independence, will obviously it would mean a closer relationship with France, returning France to a foothold or a significant foothold on the North American continent for the first time since the 18th century. And given France's present conflictual relationship with the United States, that might be of some significance. Also, it's interesting to note that France, unlike a good deal of the EU, has been much more forthcoming towards socialist Cuba of late, something that the Cubans themselves have noticed and commented upon.
Well, let me say that, first of all, I think that the question of self-determination, I come from the, the nationalist tradition in the United States, although I don't consider myself a nationalist, but I don't think nationalism is necessarily a bad thing. So I know, for example, that the whole question of self-determination has always been one that has been shared by African Americans and the Quebecois. In fact, I remember, one of the first cases of COINTELPRO was some people were charged, that you and I both know, with supposedly going to bomb the Statue of Liberty. I think Mr. Herman Ferguson was involved in that controversy. Mm-hmm. So there was a relationship between African people in the United States and the Quebecois then. And there was also a question of the Quebecois in the 60s and 70s. There was a lot of contact. So, first of all, I support the right of the people of Quebec to have self-determination. And to fast forward to today, I think that the momentum for self-determination in the Quebecois is a top issue now, because the Canadian government has not delivered the goods to the people of Quebec as well as to the country. Be it the Liberals or the Conservatives, the governments that we have had have not really delivered in the Quebec situation. And the province of Quebec, or the nation state of Quebec, or the that wants to be self-determined, that is the most progressive area in the country on many levels. And there are people of African origin, be they Haitian, Cameroonian, who are involved in the left in Quebec. But at the same time, there is, there are many African people that are nationalists, and they say the Quebecois is a straight up racist situation, and there's no difference between the English and the French. But I imagine, to take a leaf from your book, you know, some people that don't want to recognize the class character of the world situation, and don't want to realize there is a principle of self-determination. And so, for example, those people might argue that, you know, what about the native people in Quebec? You know, there's no such thing as Canada, and there's no such thing as the United States, because these are settler colonies. I agree. However, I think that, you know, nation states change from time to time, and historically they are historically evolved. So, you know, like the United States was, I don't think we're going to go back to, you know, the red man, as we used to say, running the whole United States. There definitely has to be a situation where indigenous people get their fair share of, I don't know what form that would take. And I think the same thing applies to Canada. So yes, I think the question of self-determination is a hot issue. It's a front burner issue. The people in Quebec are really leading the struggle in this whole country. And I think that Giuseppe, who is the leader, I think he was an ex-Maoist. He comes from a left position, socialist position, and if it were to go to a vote today, I think it would be very, very close, and I think that the people that want to have a self-determination and have their own state, I think they would win if you had that election tomorrow.
Of course, I guess Gomery has a lot to do with that. But what about the second part, which is, if that were to happen, what would be some of the downstream consequences? What would that mean for so-called English-speaking Canada? As I'm suggesting, would that mean English-speaking Canada, without the progressive anchor of Quebec, would be more susceptible to the overtures from south of the border?
And I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. I think while I support the right of self-determination, I think that Quebec would be viewed as, say, you view Cuba, or it might be. I know they would be definitely put in the axis of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that would be problematic for, not to say that is wrong, but I think that the imperialists would use that to beat English speaking Canada into submission, and I think that the right wing of the nation state of Canada would say, okay, let us get this new military guy from Canada. What's his name? He was on the radio today. Hiller.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It would give a lot of fuel to their his arguments. Yeah.
Does that also suggest that the right wing in English-speaking Canada is either overtly or covertly pro-Quebec sovereignty today?
The right wing would be pro-Quebec sovereignty?
I'm asking.
No. I don't think they would be pro-Quebec sovereignty.
I see.
No, I really don't. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Because you have a lot of left-wing people that are not pro-Quebec sovereignty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people that claim to be on the left, but they don't see Canada to be. They don't want Canada to be broken up.
I see.
I don't even know if even Mr. Layton, if he goes along with the question of Quebec having their own having self determination for Quebec.
Who does?
I don't know if Mr. Jack Layton, as an individual. I don't know if he's down with self determination for Quebec.
Oh, I'd be very interested not only in getting the answer to that question, but getting a better perspective on the NDP position on Quebec sovereignty as a whole.
Well, definitely, I can. I know a little bit about that, but that would be something that I'll work on in the next couple of weeks, and we can talk about that in detail.
Oh, good, good, good. You know, there was another important development this past week, Norman. The Financial Times, just a day or so ago, said an event that was perhaps a turning point in global economic history took place. And I'm referring, of course, to the revaluation of the Chinese currency.
That was my next question.
Well, yes. I mean, I'd be interested to hear how Toronto newspapers have played it. The Washington Post, for example, played the whole question as China knuckling under to pressure from the United States. But the Financial Times of London had a very different perspective. They see this perhaps as the beginning of an unraveling of one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world, that is to say, that between Beijing and Washington. As I've said many times, and as we've discussed many times on these airwaves, the U.S. government is heavily dependent upon money from China since Bush and the ruling elite have cut taxes on the wealthy. And the way this country keeps going is basically that China recycles its enormous, immense dollar holdings through the United States by buying U.S. Treasury bonds, which are then used to finance education, healthcare, etc. And some are wondering why a country that has so many poor people like the United States is basically financing the U.S. government. Wouldn't that money be put to better use in China itself? And to quote an old Chinese proverb, a trip of 1,000 miles often begins with one step. And this revaluation of the Chinese yuan, or renminbi, upward might be the beginning of a long journey that could have enormous consequence, negative consequence, in particular for North America.
So I lost you. Someone just walked into the studio. You wanted to know how the press is playing it?
Yeah, I'm curious. How did the Globe and Mail, the Star, et cetera, how did they play this enormous issue?
The Globe and some. First of all, you have the Globe and Mail, the business press, and the so-called liberal paper, the Toronto Star, and the National Post, and the Sun. They have similar positions, but some of them are. There was one editorial, or one columnist was basically saw it as a good thing. I think that was in the Toronto Star, and I think they were basically saying, sort of payback to the U.S. It was like they wanted to see the U.S. As a sinking ship, and this was as an example of that happening.
Well, they may be onto something.
But
certainly, it has been more example of increased Chinese assertiveness, which you're going to see a lot more of as this century unfolds.
But it's definitely a hot news item in all of the papers here. I'm talking front page news, and some people are like running scared. Like I say, you know, you have the Star, which is supposed to be the most liberal, the Globe and Mail, which the right wing says is another liberal paper, and then you have the reactionary Sun and the National Post. And I guess the most important thing is that they all support, Canadian imperialism, but they have different tactics that they want to see, you know, China move to.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, it's hard to downplay the significance of this event. And I might also add, it's also hard to downplay the significance of something that happened in Berlin the other day, which is that elections will be taking place in Germany in 60 days. Now, all of the news reports are suggesting that Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder is going down and that his right-wing opponent, Angela Merkel, will be succeeding him as the leader of this locomotive of European Union, a country of 82 million people in the heart of Europe. But at the same time, I think we should pay attention to some developments on the left in Germany. Many of the left forces have come together in a new formation they call the Left Party, and they're going to have significant impact on this election. It's interesting that part of the left discourse in Germany has invaded the upper reaches of the elite. What I'm referring to is that the left in Germany has been putting quite a significant amount of attention on these so-called hedge funds, these speculative investors, who come into countries and basically pick them clean. And they refer to these hedge funds as locusts. And that term has also been used, interestingly enough, by certain members of the German elite to refer to these hedge funds that are based in the United States in particular. So this election is going to be of critical significance. I might add parenthetically. Oh, I shouldn't use that.
Parenthetically.
Michael Jackson, your old friend, is talking about moving to Berlin after his travails in the United States.
Berlin?
That's right.
I mean, I heard something like that, but I mean, Michael is, he is my friend, but that, he's almost as erratic as Muammar Gaddafi. I shouldn't have said that. But Berlin.
Well, that was one random news item. I mean, apparently, you know, Berlin is a very hip city. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a very avant-garde city. A lot of artists are in Berlin. It's radical politics are endemic in Berlin. Berlin, which was at one time a divided city between a socialist East and a non-socialist West.
And the East
was united, but that whole socialist ethos still prevails to a large degree, and that makes the city quite inviting for many, and apparently inviting for Michael Jackson.
Well, you know, I think when the day I met you, there was, I think I met you at an American Historian conference.
Right.
And downtown Toronto, and they had a seminar on Berlin, and I think in East Berlin, the last concert that was played, it was Karl Marx Theater. I think it was American blues singer performed at that theater. I remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Berlin is a city well worth visiting. And let me say for the record, I'm not getting any kickbacks from the Tourist Bureau in Berlin. This is a sincerely held opinion.
No, but I'm just saying that, you know, Michael Jackson, well, I thought he was going to go to Cape Town. He, you know, he went to Bahrain because his brother, Muhammad Abdul Aziz, who is, that's Jermaine Jackson, he's been a Muslim since 1988. You know, he's friends with the Prime Minister, Prime Minister or President is Omar Bongo President or Prime Minister of Gabon?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is he President or Prime Minister? I can't remember.
President.
So I mean, he's got all of those. He can go to the, you know, to a lot of Muslim countries as well as African countries. I can imagine he would be welcome in many parts of the Caribbean.
Oh yeah, clearly. But apparently, he's not targeting London as a place for visit or even residence, which is understandable. I don't know if you heard about the horrible shooting on the London subway of the South Asian man and the very graphic testimony by an eyewitness who saw what was going down, which it the way it was described, it almost sounded like a political assassination. I mean, the British police are not known necessarily for carrying weapons or even for engaging the kinds of police killings that are so endemic, for example, in the United States of America.
That sounds like a Los Angeles hit.
I think that's of what's going on in Britain now with the rising hysteria against South Asians in light of the tragic events of July 7th and the apparent attempt to replicate July 7th on July 21st just a couple of days ago. Britain is on edge, and of course, in a certain sense, this is an inevitable outgrowth of British aggression in Iraq, being the lapdog of Yankee imperialism in terms of that illegal and criminal invasion of Iraq, and of course, Tony Blair basically co-signing all of these bogus checks that George W. Bush has been writing. I think it's long past time for us to conclude and concede that whatever understandable and justifiable criticisms we do have, in point of fact, of some of the tactics of the so-called Islamic fundamentalists, the basic fact of the matter is that this is a political struggle. In other words, as Al-Qaeda put it in a statement right before the U.S. election, they're not attacking Sweden, they're attacking Britain. And there are political reasons for that. They did not crash a plane into the Vatican, they crashed a plane into the Pentagon. Now, I think that's the beginning of wisdom, and that's the beginning of trying to come to grips with and grapple with the very difficult questions that this phenomenon of so-called fundamentalism is going to present to us going forward.
Well, you know, they shot that that brother in London like they shoot Negroes in South Central L.A. That was a real, that's like, remind me of Watts, you know.
Did you hear the eyewitness report from?
Yes, I did.
On the BBC.
Yes.
It was quite graphic, almost novelistic in detail. I would urge listeners to perhaps go to the BBC website to see if they can recover that audio, because it'll make your hair stand out on end if it already isn't.
I'm speaking with Professor Gerald Horn, the author of Red Seas, a book about Ferdinand Smith, and also Black and Brown, about the Mexican Revolution and African Americans, and Race War, a great book. What type of feedback have you heard about your last visit?
Oh, you know, quite positive. I certainly enjoyed it. I can't wait to return to Toronto. I mean, you know, I have to confess, off the record, please don't reveal this to anybody, if you don't mind. And one of the reasons I like coming to Toronto, I'm oftentimes looking for places of exile in case they chase me out of this country.
Right.
And I have to say that Toronto is high on my list in case these U.S. authorities decide that my residence here is no longer compatible with their interests.
Yeah, well, Canada, yeah, you come. I have a couple of battles that I would like to help get your legal advice on, because I have an issue with Mayor Miller. I won't go into, I'm not going into the, into it in detail with you today, but, yeah, you could definitely help us with some issues up here.
You know, well, you know, if things keep going the way they are in this country, you know, you might see me there sooner rather than later. And on a somber note, Norman, you might have heard that Eugene Record of the Shy Lights passed away.
Oh yeah, we're getting ready to play him after we conclude.
Yeah, it's quite sad. I mean, you know, I think the Shy Lights, their music has had enormous impact. I think you can get an understanding of that just by listening to contemporary music and hearing and listening to all the so-called samples of Shy Light music that you hear in contemporary music, like some of Beyonce's music, for example. She samples Shy Light's hits. And then, of course, I forwarded you that email about the great Motown producer Norman Whitfield, who's had some legal difficulties and just got convicted on tax issues. Tax issues, of course, is the all-purpose issue that they nail people on in this country, and apparently they've nailed Norman Whitfield.
Well, Norman Whitfield is quite a character. Yeah.
Oh, you know him?
I don't know him. I met him. At the Los Angeles Coliseum, I think it was in 1978, there was a concert with Parliament Funkadelic, Bootsy's Rubber Band, the Isley Brothers, Chaka Khan, Brothers Johnson, and I remember the Isley Brothers, after Bootsy's Rubber Band burned up the stage, the Isley Brothers refused to come out, and I was backstage for that when I met Mr. Whitfield then. And Carol Cole, I think that's Nat King Cole's adopted daughter. Met a lot of people. I don't know if you're familiar with Azizi Johari. Azizi Johari was a Playboy bunny.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, she. I met her. I think I was looking at Marvin Gaye's wife, Janice Hunter. I think I was probably foaming at the mouth, and she said, "Do you want to meet? That's Marvin Gaye's wife. Let me introduce you to her." But anyway, it ended up that Azizi Johari was born in the same parish that I was born in Louisiana, and I quite came to be kind of close to her. But I met Mr. Whitfield there, and he was Norman Whitfield was very self-confident. I mean, because apparently that song "Papa Was a Rolling Stone." He made that song, "I Was a Third of September, the Day I'll Always Remember," was actually the day that Dennis Edwards' father died.
Mm.
And he made Dennis sing that, and Dennis hated it. And if you listen to the way Dennis sings it, he's really mad. But needless to say, when it went triple platinum and started winning the Grammys, I think Dennis, his jaws were no longer tight. But Eugene Record...
I should also mention that the United Nations emissary... who traveled to Harare, Zimbabwe, to investigate the demolition of these makeshift homes in that nation's capital, has issued a stinging indictment of the government of Robert Mugabe. Interestingly enough, the indictment issued by the UN emissary does not call for bringing the Zimbabwe regime to the International Criminal Court, which is something that London in particular was clamoring for. But in any case, it's one more bit of evidence with regard to the gathering pressure against the Mugabe regime. Although, interestingly enough, Mr. Mugabe himself has been in Beijing all of this week There has been a deepening relationship between China and Zimbabwe. Of course, the relationship between the ruling party and Harare in China goes all the way back to the liberation movement. But since the difficulties Mr. Mugabe has gotten himself into with regard to relations with London, Ottawa, Washington, etc., this has been an opening and an opportunity for China. And, of course, if you go to Harare nowadays, you'll see significant evidence of this Chinese influence. And I think that's one of the reasons, amongst many, if you ask me, why the South Africans have been rather reluctant to crack down on the Zimbabwe government, which, of course, they've been encouraged to do so by London in particular, because relations between the ruling parties in South Africa and China over the years have not been the best. And certainly, as China deepens its relationship with Zimbabwe, this is something that South Africa, it seems to me, have to look at with a wary eye.
Let me ask you this last question about Zimbabwe. Those charges, do you think that, is there anything else behind that, or is Mugabe just doing this?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a complicated question. The detractors of the regime suggest that Harare, being a bastion of opposition to the ruling party, and with urban residents being a bastion of opposition to the ruling party, of course, ZANU-PF gets a significant amount of its support in the rural areas, in the countryside, where the white farmers rule. It was said that this was punishment to the opposition by knocking down these homes. Mr. Mugabe, of course, did not see it that way, certainly in terms of the kinds of human rights violations that you see in Africa with Niger, on basically the brink of famine, which, of course, you hardly read anything about in the English-language press, with people being burned to death in eastern Congo, which has been happening over the past few days. It's hard to see why Zimbabwe gets this kind of coverage in light of what's going on the rest of the continent. So I have to say, I have a very conflicted viewpoint, as you know, with regards to this question. On the one hand, seeing human rights violations in Zimbabwe, but on the other hand, feeling that too much is made of it because of an incessant, and I might also say racist, concern about the fate and plight of a handful of farmers of European extraction.
All right. I think it's time for us to get in the whirlwind, and I will have a report for you about the NDP's position on Quebec next week.
Yeah, I'll be very curious to hear that.
All right, and we're going to go out with Have You Seen Her by Eugene Record and the Shylights.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Mm-hmm.